Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordani, where we introduce you to authors, whether they've been around for a long time or first-time writers from many other fields, because we like to talk to people across the spectrum, hence the name Book Spectrum. Today, we all want to look into our pasts and our ancestries. When we have a relative who was a war hero, yet with little information about how or where he or she may have served and possibly died, our curiosity tends to want us to find out more. With me is a man who did that, Kenneth James Moore. But in writing a book about his uncle, a bomber pilot in the World War II Pacific, in doing his research, Kenneth found more. Much more. When horrors of the past are hidden and brushed aside, how can we learn from them? In his debut novel, Pieces of Wood, Kenneth James Moore explores a dark piece of World War II history rarely discussed and not taught in schools here in the States. This brings to light the atrocities Imperial Japan inflicted on millions of innocent women. Kenneth James Moore, welcome to Book Spectrum.
Chris, it's very kind of you to have me on your show, sir.
Kenneth, this novel is your first, but it came about through your discoveries while researching the fate of your uncle during World War II. Before we get to Pieces of Wood, what inspired you on the initial journey?
Well, it began, frankly, when I was 8 years old. My mom lost her youngest brother, with whom she was quite connected. She we had a picture of him on a mantle in our home as I was growing up as a little boy, and I was seemingly I looked a lot like him. Or there were always constant comparisons. So anytime I did anything good or bad or anything like that, I was always compared to my uncle. But I would come home from school, and my mom would be holding the portrait, and she'd be crying. And I said to her one day, I said, "Hey, I'll find out. I'll do this for you." And I was a very sickly kid, and she always took care of me, so sort of a bit of reciprocity, if you will. So it came about as a result of this pledge I made, and just through time and through scenarios that arose along the way, I continued. I was very fortunate. I was an investment banker in Beverly Hills, and had the financial wherewithal to carry out this quest, and so I did. And 32 years later, or actually 27 years later, we found, my teammates and I, we found the airplane that my uncle was piloting, a B-29 bomber, 1,600 miles away from where the U.S. government said it had gone down, in 80 feet of water. We dove it and made the identification. And then we found the aircraft, and then 5 years later, we had I received irrefutable evidence of his demise in the former Soviet Union.
Let's talk about your uncle as a war hero, Kenneth. You discussed his demise, you discussed what he was doing, but what else did you find out about him and his efforts during the war?
A kid from Walla Walla, Washington, basically a town that had just received sidewalks prior to his enlistment. He was a high school graduate, just a kid. But he had this passion inherited from my grandfather, who had fled the Soviet Union during the Bolshevik Revolution, and had this passion for freedom. And it just was a really compelling environment for service to others, I guess would be a good way of putting it. He felt a real desire to do that, and he enlisted as a basic, grunt, foot soldier, and then received recognition for his mechanical skills, which he actually learned at Sears Roebuck as a result of my father, who was an executive for Sears, got him the job there. Uncle Billy, or Billy, we'll just refer to him that way if we would. He had these innate skills of fixing anything from toasters to lawnmowers to any other mechanical issue. So that was ultimately recognized by the military, and So he became an airplane mechanic, but he always had this desire to fly, and it was a, he'd see the crop dusters, what have you, and through Walla Walla, through the Washington State wheat fields, and that turned him on. That was his thing. So he applied, and by God, this kid from Walla Walla, Washington, with a high school degree, went to pilot school. You know, that's just, I find that to be phenomenal. So he and was he received an assignment. He flew I think it was, a B-24 out of Cuba, chasing German submarines out of the Gulf of Mexico. They had to skim right over the water in order to do that. So he actually had windshield wipers on his bomber. Also had one of the very first sonar scenarios built into the aircraft. So he had that kind of a cutting edge aspect to his experiences in the military. And then he was handpicked by a guy by the name of General Haywood Hansel, who I interviewed. He along with another guy named Jack Riley, were amongst these, I refer to him kind of like the original Apollo space crew, because these guys were unique. Jack Riley had, he was at the 8th Air Force in Europe before going to the Pacific, and he had 20 some missions under his belt. Also had a phenomenal IQ of 170. He was a unique human being. Both Uncle Billy and Jack were high school athletes and all-star athletes. So they had a lot of commonality between them. But in terms of that, what I found out about my uncle was he was just one of these average Joe guys who just excelled given the circumstances.
With me is Kevin James Moore. He's the author of Pieces of Wood on Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordani. You traveled the world looking for answers and more information on your uncle, but you came across something even more interesting, something that you didn't get to learn in school. When and how did you come to focus on the island of Saipan and discover what the Imperial Japanese were doing to women there?
My uncle flew out of the neighboring island of Tinian, so part of the Mariana Archipelago, 14 islands, which basically look like stepping stones across the Pacific. And on Tinian Island, it's the same there's a runway alpha, the same runway that the Anola Gay took off from. My uncle and the 398 bomber group were stationed there. Of the 3,300 off the top of my head, 3,390, I think, B-29s that were produced, all but one went to Mariana Islands, Guam, Saipan, Tinian, et cetera. So this was a massive undertaking. It was to go to Tinian, to walk as I had, the same runway, looking through the same experiences that these gentlemen did, I was able to really kind of put myself into my uncle's shoes and try to get a real grasp of what he had undertaken. And indeed, I met several people who were members of the 398th along the way. So we were looking for clues. I had put together so much documentation, literally huge boxes of documentation, interviews that I collected over the 27 years prior to going to the Marianas. So this was like, first time getting my feet wet. We went to the first time in 1998. And on Saipan, which is still what now is called the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, the CNMI. It's the headquarters of the CNMI. We were told that there was a B-29 that had gone down atop of Mount Tapatio, the largest or the highest elevation in the islands. And so we thought, well, hey, let's go take a look at that. You know, maybe there's something, some element of it there that would help us understand. Understand my uncle's demise and or more specifically understand, well, how a B-29 functions. So anyhow, we thought we could learn from the opportunity. So myself, my primary associate, Glenn Palacios, Glenn and I hiked Mount Tapatio, which was no fun, by the way. It's basically a rock. And it had been an inactive volcano, but the most exposed part of it is nothing but a sheer rock. So we climbed that, found the bomber, but before doing that, we're looking around and we're going, well, what, the Saipan jungle is the most intense jungle on the planet, according to the Central Intelligence Agency. It is really, really bad. There's no such thing as a tree. It's all just these vines, and it's a very dangerous element once you're above and beyond the sheer rock, by the way, once you're into the volcano per se. It's very intense, and it's also incredibly humid and incredibly hot. So it's very demanding to be in that environment. So we're making our way across what is called a Calderas Plain, being that element that when a volcano explodes and then, you know, it settles back down, it forms a plain, a flat surface. And along that flat surface, then all the vines and stuff that are endemic to the Mariana Archipelago just fill that place. It's almost difficult to even compare it to anything else because the intensity of the jungle, it's, you know, at 10 o'clock in the morning, it's like 7 o'clock at night. It's that intense. There's a blanket over the top of the jungle. Its visibility is a challenge. So nonetheless, we're going across the Calderas Plain now that I've explained what that is. And we're looking for this down B-29 we heard about. So I was the one that actually noticed this. Well, there's this big hole there.
Let's go into what was happening with the women when you made the discovery. These women who were taken from their daughters or families taken from China and other nations, the Imperial Japanese, that is, occupied at the time. They were taken to be comfort women, and this is what you discovered down there. And, of course, that's where you get the title Pieces of Wood.
Well, again, going across this Calderas Plain, we saw this large circumference, which was it was enclosed with all sorts of, you know, vines. But it was not something, it had to be man-made. It was not a natural phenomenon. So we cut away the vines and looked inside, and there's these grids, like a skeletal aspect of an airplane or a boat. There's these grids which basically hold the unit together. I crawled in, and these grids were, I think they're, the unit itself, as we finally discovered, it was probably 4 feet by 6 feet long, and these grids were, maybe 200, 250 pounds each, and maybe 4 or 6 of them, so it's not exactly something that would be in a boat or an airplane, and so I started, digging through it, trying to figure out what the heck it was. There were inscriptions of the manufacturer on over my left shoulder. I was 6'1", 210, and I fit snugly in there, but I could move, but not very much. So I could see what was about me. And so I started pulling out, there's just huge amounts of dust. I defined it as dust at the time. It was obviously human residue. There were big pieces of green and yellow and red, multicolored fabric. Now, well, Imperial Japanese didn't have anything to do with that. And it's just certainly far bigger than a bread oven, you know. So as we spent the next several days coming back over a course of actually several weeks to clean it out, it became a refractory oven. These things were professionally built. We're at about a 1,200 to 1,400 foot elevation, again, off the top of my head. These things are highly decorated, highly designed brick ovens. And they are layered with refractory brick. Refractory brick, obviously, something that repels heat. And then over that, there's a cement layer. And they're decorated. It's like somebody a craftsman put a lot of time into this. And we figured it had to be like 1931 to 34, where the Japanese were given the Marianas as a protectorate after World War I, or they then in this time frame started to occupy it more, or took the first step for the occupation of it per se. So we figured it had to be built then. So somebody, and there was two that were still standing, but there was a whole field of broken bricks. And if you've ever been in the Marianas, and when a typhoon hits, yeah, not even a refractory oven or anything's going to survive. it was quite the experience to actually lay inside of an oven where these women were barbecued, and that's precisely the term that has to be used, because they were thrown in there alive. I know this because I had subsequently interviewed a Marine who was a captain at the time. He lives in the Chicago area.
Let's stop here. Kenneth James Moore is with me on Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordani. We're talking about his book, Pieces of Wood. This is something that we never hear discussed. The Japanese atrocities, the Imperial Japanese atrocities from World War II, we seem to be glossed over when it comes to learning about the war. In high school, you learn about the German occupation and the concentration camps and what happened there. But there is, for some reason, never or barely any talk about Room 731, Dr. Ishii, and a lot of the other quote-unquote medical personnel getting off scot-free virtually. Their careers flourished after World War II. Treatment of Chinese prisoners, all an afterthought. And these atrocities towards women who were considered, and again, that's your title, pieces of wood, all swept under the rug. So how surprised were you to find all this? And when you were reading more about this, how surprised were you to find that, why isn't anybody discussing this? Or why doesn't anybody mention this when it comes to World War II atrocities from the Axis powers?
Well, because we've all grew up with as baby boomers, you know, and even in current generations, we hear nothing but, you know, the Germans did this, the Germans did that, Schindler and the Schindler List and Saving Private Ryan. It's all focused on the Nazi occupation period, but the Nazis would not have gotten anywhere had not Hitler simply watched Hirohito and the Japanese beginning in 1931 and saw that we in the United States did very little to suppress Imperial Japanese efforts to overtake, well, essentially half the globe. I think this is one of the most fascinating aspects from my standpoint is that, yeah, okay, Hitler got to the gates of Stalingrad, to the beaches of Normandy, okay, but the Japanese basically occupied everything, or made the attempt to occupy everything, from their homeland to Alaska, and had indeed had a thing called Operation. it's a very colorful name. I had come up. I'll think of it as we progress. Operation Cherry Blossoms at Night.
That's it. There it is. Cherry Blossoms at Night.
Yep, absolutely. It was. You mentioned Dr. Ishii, who, by the way, was not only just a doctor; he was a three-star general, and he was the prince. He is Hirohito's first cousin.
And again, they got off scot-free pretty much after World War II, in exchange for medical knowledge.
And that medical knowledge was somewhat, it was okay, it wasn't great, it wasn't what our expectations were, but your point is exactly right, Chris. They got off scot-free, and it's a phenomenon. But they killed millions of women. And why targeting the women? Because, well, who's going to be the procreators of the countries or the land that the Japanese want to occupy? Everybody needs to quite understand the fact that Japan per se is a series of little islands, of which about 80%, according to research, is not occupiable, either for residential or for commercial or for farming purposes. So they wanted to get the hell off of their own land and occupy somebody else's. So in order to do that, yeah, you kill the men on the battlefield, but you got to take care of those women too. And when we talk about, we say atrocities always occur in war. God, I hate people when they say that. Because this isn't seeing it all like
this is over the line here.
Yeah, this is a battle plan. This is like landing on the beaches of Normandy. You know, they set out to do this. I have it in my record someplace. It's an actual battle plan from the Imperial Courts, Battle Plan 465 or whatever it was. This was intended. And I really also have great problem with the use of the term comfort women.
Well, that's what they used. That's what they said. They were comfort women for the soldiers. But, they were pretty much considered by the government, by the Imperial Japanese, people you could just throw away. Nothing. And again, that's where the title Pieces of Wood comes along. So I want to get to this part of the question, Kenneth James Moore. What made you tell the story of Japanese atrocities in the Pacific in novel form? Keep in mind, you could have done an encyclopedia on this, but why did you want to tell the story in novel form through Pieces of Wood?
So people would read it. So people would get it. This information I dug up, it's there. You know, it's not like I had to go to incredible lengths, although I did in some instances. But for the most part, it's there. It's out there. I just simply sewed it together, and it had to be told in a fashion which entertained. And frankly, even that aspect of the international crime thriller aspect of the novel bears considerable amount of truth. So it is a novel, so I can't really say much more than that. But the fact that it was attempted to be brought to the United States, oh hell yes, that actually occurred, or the overtures for it occurring took place.
Kenneth, in addition to your findings in the book and you're trying to expose them and raising awareness for all of this, you've taken on the cause to eliminate violence against women throughout your life. How does that come out in Pieces of Wood?
Well, I was a martial arts expert in the early 80s, and I had was sitting around with my wife one day. We were watching TV, and this stuff on self-defense, or if a woman gets attacked, you should do this. You should, be able to kick them in the groin bit, or reach into your purse and pull out a weapon, or a can of mace. It made me absolutely vomitous. I couldn't believe that was actually being promoted on a commercial basis. So in 1981, I went to the YWCA in Annapolis, Maryland, or that was their headquarters in Maryland. And I pitched my idea for a six-week course for self-defense for women, a course specifically designed for a woman being attacked. And I think it was quite successful. I taught it primarily thereafter at the University of Maryland College Park campus, and taught it throughout the state of Maryland and in Virginia. And then I gave it to one of my students who was a principal of a high school, and she was great, so I just gave it to her and it went from there. So when we taught at the Y, we didn't charge anybody. We taught we charge $40 for a 6-week course at the University of Maryland. So my interest in that began from that standpoint. Plus, I've always preferred the company of women. I just feel always the guys always doing the comparison bit, the one up bit, and all that stuff. So I don't usually have that with women. So I always felt good, more comfortable with that. So somebody who picks on a woman, to me, that's just good. That's a barbaric.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's just out there. So, and then this is a one individual case, or it happens on the street of Baltimore or Annapolis or whatever. But this was when I went to the Marianas, and we came across these ovens and going, holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is way over any perception that I could have even imagined.
Kenneth, you shouldn't have been surprised. This should have been exposed a long time ago. This should have been discussed. This should have been talked about. Yeah, nowadays you might see a lot on maybe Unit 731 or a couple of camps or the way Chinese prisoners were treated in documentaries, but nothing like this. You don't see a lot on this. Maybe the occasional website or blog post, but not very much on this subject.
Do you know how many sub-chapters Unit 731 has? That's another thing that bothers me a lot. People refer to Unit 731, but there was numerous camps like Unit 731 or under the same auspices.
Right, exactly. It's just that's the one that I guess came out in the history books, and since it was General Dr. Ishii that was in charge, that's where you get the attention. Having said that, what's the most important thing readers should take away from Pieces of Wood altogether?
I hope they're entertained by the thriller, as it were. But what they must take away, absolutely must take away, is the backstory. Because this happened. This happened not in the 16th or the 12th century. This happened in the 20th century, where the discomfort women, I you can use it as a separate category. Some supposedly 2.2 million girls, these weren't women, these were girls, yanked away from their parents, where their parents were killed in the process, and taken from China down to the Philippines, doctor, all across anywhere the Japanese military were. These women, these girls, were dragged beside them. We came across a site where there's a Marine Corps landing on Saipan. I'm sorry, it was on Tinian, and there was makeshift pillboxes there, wooden or out of the jungle climb. They made these makeshift. The Japanese made these makeshift pillboxes. Well, gee, what was fascinating about them is where did all these fine pieces of china come from? All these broken fragments, or these fragments of really good china. My parents were well-to-do. I could identify what a good china looked like. What are they doing here in this pillbox on the beach on Tinian? And what's this little container? Oh, these containers were this is vagina cream, vaginal cream jars. I had them interpreted. They were Japanese inscribed, but these were vaginal cream jars. So these women were right there as the Marines are coming ashore, and the Japanese, who are always drunk, by the way, I mean, there's sake bottles everywhere, in these pill boxes and elsewhere, and in the ovens, by the way. Right there at the firing line, having to be service the men as they were defending or against the United States Marine Corps. Fascinating crap like that. And it's just how in one's brainwave, I don't care if you're Japanese, Asian, or if you're whatever you are, how do you put that into your brainwave that that's okay?
No, you don't. Let's put it this way. The Imperial Japanese were an evil regime. You brainwash your people into following it, and this is what happens. They get that kind of mentality.
Exactly. And it's, but I think in answer to your question, it what people need to understand when by reading pieces of wood is this happened then, 20th century, not that long ago. And if you don't understand it, if you don't sweep it out from underneath the carpet and let it be exposed, the probability of it happening again, maybe not in the same venue or the same style, but mass murder. Come on, it happens all the time around in the United States. Nothing of, you know, nothing where millions, but often tens, and a lot of women are often put in position of this. It's barbaric, and this barbarity continues, and it can escalate. And I really think it's important for people to look at how bad it once got to make sure it never happens again.
Kenneth James Moore, thank you very much for being with us on Book Spectrum.
I had a good time, Chris. Thank you very much.
Once again, the name of the book is Pieces of Wood. It's a novel about the World War II atrocities against women by the Imperial Japanese from Kenneth James Moore. You can find a link to more information on Kenneth and to buy the book on our website, bookspectrum.com. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Chris Cordani, and enjoy the read.